This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
Hi there, I'm Gian Gomeshi. This is Q, the podcast. Highlights from the November 13th edition of Q, the program. Okay, on your podcast today, a look at the Writers Guild of America strike from its front lines. I'm joined by a Canadian writer for the Colbert Report and Canadian TV scribe Dennis McGrath for their take on the situation. And Ani DeFranco, like a blizzard coming off Lake Erie, she burst out of Buffalo in the early 90s and became a female indie icon. Now she's put out a two-disc career retrospective, a feature interview with Ani playing live in Studio Q. Don't miss that. And Jesse Wente looks at the new era of war movies. Hey, Brian. Didn't we do this already? This is Q. Okay, it's week two of the television and film writers' strike down in the United States. The Writers Guild of America is fighting for a bigger cut of the money from TV's new media platforms. So we're talking iTunes downloads, internet streaming, and DVDs. So far, it doesn't look like anyone, not even California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, is prepared to step in and end the strike anytime soon. So today we're checking with two Canadian television writers from either side of the border. Barry Julian can normally be found skewering the likes of Bill O'Reilly. He's a senior writer on the hit satirical spinoff, The Colbert Report. But these days, he's one of 2,500 writers on the streets in Manhattan. Barry is in our CBC studio, just a few blocks over from the picketing writers at Rockefeller Center. Hello, Barry.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm tired. And I'm terrified. There's a picture of Rex Murphy glaring at me on the wall. It's unsettling.
Well, we'll speak about various things that you're terrified by in just a moment. It's good to have you back on the show, by the way. And Dennis McGrath is a TV writer up here in Canada, writing for TV shows like Rent-A-Goalie and the upcoming series Across the River to Motor City. He's also a member of Q's own TV Observers, the Tube Team. Dennis is here with me in Studio Q. Hello, sir.
Hey.
Good to have you here. Well, Barry, I'm missing new editions of the Colbert Report. You're closest to the action down there in New York. So let's start with you. What's the mood like on the picket line at 30 Rockefeller Center?
Well, we're actually not picketing at 30 Rock today. We were there on the first day last Monday. Today we're down on Wall Street. And tomorrow we're going to be in front of the Disney store. It's changed every day. We've been picketing outside different studios at Chelsea Piers where they do Law & Order, and last week we were at Silver Cup where they do 30 Rock. And the mood in the first week was, I think you captured it quite well off the top there. It's kind of weird and, exciting in a way because everybody is so unified. The writers are so completely, together on this, but, you know, we have some of the best jobs in the business. I feel like I do, and I would really love to be doing it right now. So there's kind of a low-grade depression and stress that comes with it. None of us really wants to be out there. We'd love to be doing our jobs, which we worked very hard to get.
Right. What's the most badly written strike slogan you've heard so far?
Oh, somebody did some signs that said, "We want our words worth," which that was a bit of a groaner for me.
It's quite genius, actually.
Yeah.
Okay, Dennis, what immediate effect has the strike had on major U.S. shows airing here in Canada?
Well, you know, it's interesting, actually, because Canadian networks, the private Canadian networks anyway, are so dependent on those U.S. shows, much more so than just about any other country other than the United States. You know, other places would maybe try to fill the holes with their own indigenous programming, but, you know, in Canada, we don't have a lot of that, so... CTV and Global find themselves scrambling, mostly because they've got to make the decisions really quickly because they don't know what the U.S. networks are going to do.
So what shows will be affected if the strike continues in the months ahead?
Well, I mean, all of them. I mean, you know, CTV's already pulled, I think they've pulled the reruns of the Colbert Report, and you know, the late night shows are all off the air or in repeats already.
What do you mean? They've pulled reruns?
Yeah, they're putting in TMZ and
so they're not even running the Colbert Report in reruns?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. And then you figure this is going to generalize for all U.S. shows.
Well, basically, most of the U.S. shows, I mean, the last things I checked, they all have probably enough to get through the sweeps in November. You know, TV generally tends to go away a little bit in December and then come back in January. And I think, realistically, a lot of the shows are not going to come back in January now. And some of the ones that weren't completed, like 24, has been put off indefinitely because they didn't have enough in the can.
Barry, almost daily we're seeing celebrities, and I talked about this in the opener as well, Steve Carell, Julia Louis-Dreyfus on the picket line. Mm-hmm. How important is their endorsement to the writers' bargaining position, do you figure?
I think it's pretty huge because... you know, when they show up, the cameras show up, and obviously that brings attention to our side of things, and, you know, they bring a certain credibility, and so when people see that Tina Fey is marching around with us for hours on end, or Tim Robbins, Julianne Moore, all of those people, it just helps kind of get our side of the story across, even in a conceptual way, because unfortunately, the people we're up against own the media, and so we're having a bit of a hard time getting our side of it out. Surprisingly,
right.
So you know, last Wednesday, for instance, we had a lot of celebrities out, and it just. It brings cameras to our side of things and gives us a chance to tell our side of the story.
And has Stephen Colbert visited you guys?
We haven't seen him on the picket line yet. I'm not sure what he and Jon Stewart have their own, because it's kind of like you don't want to play your entire hand too soon,
right.
And so that, you know, it could be an element of that. I haven't spoken to Stephen about what his plans are, but you know, there could be an element of not wanting everybody to come out too early. Sometimes you want to save some people. They may have their own plans for what they want to do, but they are fully behind the Writers Guild and this strike, and which is good because those two men in particular have a certain type of credibility and respect that even other celebrities don't.
You know, I have to say, it seems particularly strange to me that there are some actors crossing the picket line. I mean, these are always complex issues, and there's always a precariousness about crossing the picket line. But in this case, when you're crossing the picket line, and the people on the picket line are the people who write for you, mm-hmm. you know, you'd think it would be a bad idea, even if you didn't ideologically agree with the strike, to do that, you know, for fear that, you know, they're going to write you out of the next series, right?
Right. Yeah, I don't think anyone, as far as I know, is holding it against actors who go to work yet. I mean, a cheer went up there was a huge Writers Guild meeting here in New York on Wednesday night last week, and they told us about Steve Carell calling in sick, and the network was going to send a physician over to his house to check on him, quote unquote. Oh. And apparently Carell said, "That's okay, I've come down with a case of enlarged balls." So that kind of thing is, we love that, obviously, that he gets a lot of brownie points for that. But the, you know, actors would be breaking their contract and would be subject to legal action if they didn't show up for work.
Right.
So I don't think anyone's, I mean, we begrudge them a little bit because they're next. The SAG and the DGA, their contracts expire in June. And so everything we're risking our livelihoods for to get now, they're going to get next. And so it would behoove them to support us in any way they can. But I think we also recognize that they legally are required to show up for work.
Okay, well, speaking of navigating the picket line and the ethics around it, Dennis, what kind of ethical dilemma does the U.S. strike pose to Canadian writers like yourself?
Well, I mean, I'm not actually a currently WGA member because I have not worked for, you know, American producers. So I'm just WGC. The WGC, the Writers Guild of Canada, sent out an advisory for their dual members, and basically it breaks down to if you live in the United States, you're on strike. If you live in Canada, you can work for Canadian producers. You can't work for American producers. Where this gets complicated now is you got a bunch of Canadian producers out there now, out there shooting their mouths off, saying, you know, oh well, this bring some great opportunities for Canadian producers and writers to sell to the, you know, and it's just, it's a bunch of BS because there's not a single writer in either union worth their salt that really is looking about to scab and to make sort of hay out of the situation because there's no good that can come
out of it. No, but do you care about finding out, do you have a responsibility to find out whether the show you're writing for is going to be sold south of the border? And
well, I think you do. I mean, I would tend to draw that line probably further a lot than most. The way I put it, there are shows that are on U.S. cable that have part of their U.S. cable sales, like The Best Years, Degrassi, that in past years have sold. And those shows theoretically could go back into production under a WGC contract. Do you work on those? Well, you know, I think maybe you do. But at the same time, if there's a show and there's Canadian productions that have U.S. Offices that are looking to maybe make a sale and those go ahead because you really can't tell they're going ahead because of the strike, then, you know, I think morally it would be reprehensible for you to go forward on something like that.
There are also there's the issue of some productions that may be U.S. productions that move production to Canada in order to get around it.
Yeah.
Too, and so it would. I think it would behoove Canadian writers to just, you know, not that they wouldn't be aware of where their production is coming from, but that's another issue.
But see, but that's not.
I just want to play something for you guys. Not everyone in Canada sees the writer's strike as a bad thing, by the way. Yeah. I want to play a clip from from Canadian TV producer and performer Kenny Hotz. He's one half of the Showcase comedy series Kenny versus Spenny that was picked up by Comedy Central in the U.S. just about a month ago. Here's his reaction to the prospect of a prolonged writer's strike.
I was praying to Lord Satan last night that the writing strike would never end. For us, it's the greatest thing that could possibly happen at the best possible time. I think we're the only non-scripted show and the only reality show on Comedy Central. So if the strike goes on, Comedy Central in the U.S. could be, you know, Kenny versus Spenny TV. You know, we're just starting there. They're just starting to air our shows, and we already have 62 in the can. So for me, business-wise, this is the best possible thing that could have happened. You know, if I had one wish on my birthday cake right now, it's like writer strike, Los Angeles.
Barry, how do you react to that?
Well, that's cute. I assume he's being mostly funny. I'd like to believe that deep down he doesn't actually mean that because people are going to be losing homes and there's a lot of hardship that comes out of this, and the repercussions are huge. People are being laid off from their jobs. The financial impact in the cities where most of the production happens, in New York and Los Angeles, is massive.
Not to mention that I was in New York over the weekend, and the stagehand strike is also happening around the Broadway.
Yeah, that's a weird coincidence.
And this whole city seems, you know, in upheaval in terms of the entertainment industry. You know,
yeah, it's terrible. This is really, really serious, and I didn't even realize myself as we were building to the strike. I think because most of us didn't think it was going to happen, but when it did, we got a quick reality check in just what a big deal this is. You know, we have a guy on our show who's having a baby in like 2 weeks. We've got another guy who's got two kids in college. This is. I don't know. I've never felt so politically motivated about many things, and
it seems a bit of a shame that we don't have the Colbert Report and the Daily Show to comment on it.
Right? Yeah, in a way, it would be nice. Those are kind of the two premier voices.
We're tight for time here, and I know it's difficult to speculate, but let me just go to the two of you before we wrap up here. Dennis, how do you see this playing out at this point? I mean, we'll keep checking on this.
It depends. The amazing thing in the first week, anyway, is it's interesting that actually the writer's side has got out as much as it has. I mean, there are viral videos. The latest sort of poll put 69% of people in Los Angeles in favor of the writers. And the weirdest story that I saw was the AMPTP. They're being called the producers in Variety. And yesterday, a bunch of 80 Hollywood producers sent a letter to Variety saying, for God's sake, please don't call them the producers. These are big media conglomerates, you know?
So your speculation on how long this lasts?
It depends. You know what? It depends. If the ratings go down, if American Idol comes back and their audience drops, if the corporations start to feel an impact, you know, they'll get back to the table.
Barry, last word to you.
Nobody knows. I don't even think the people on the negotiating committees know at this point, because the two sides are so far apart right now. I'm not sure what can or will have to happen to end this.
Good luck, Barry. Thanks
Thank
to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Good luck, Barry.
Barry Julian is a senior writer on the Colbert Report. He was in our CBC studio in New York City, apparently under a big photo of Rex Murphy. And Dennis McGrath is a Canadian TV writer and a member of Q's Tube team. He also writes about television on his blog, Dead Things on Sticks. Dennis was with me here in studio. Q.
This is Q, the podcast. You can catch Q, the program, weekdays on CBC Radio and several times a day on Sirius 137.
Ani DeFranco has walked into the studio.
We
are going to, she strode into the studio. She's got her guitar here. We are going to chat. But first, we're going to play something from this new record called Canon, this lifetime retrospective, this
Good Lord.
Two record. I want to play a song called Both Hands, which is probably one of, Ani DeFranco, one of your first songs.
From back in the day.
Back in the day. But this is a new version of it that you recorded for this new. I'm going to do the big glamorous introduction of you in just a moment. But first, from her new record, Canon, this is Both Hands on Q, CBC Radio 1. From the new album Canon by Ani DeFranco. That is Both Hands, the new version of Both Hands, kind of bookending the career. That's a song you started with 17 years ago, 16 years ago, and a song that's on the new record. Here's the glamorous introduction. Are you ready?
Make it good.
Well, I mean, I'm just the facts, you know? Oh. She's a music pioneer. and someone who by the age of 20 had created a kind of cultural revolution in certain circles of North America. Ani DiFranco's impact on the music industry has been likened to that of Bob Dylan's. At the core of her message, female empowerment, strength and independence, defiance. Following her own gospel, Ani DiFranco founded an indie label, Righteous Babe Records, and through it released 19 albums and has sold more than 4 million copies since 1990. She's emerged as one of the most influential and inspirational cult heroines of the last two decades. And now Ani DiFranco has released a retrospective, a 2-CD set that contains 36 songs spanning her prolific 17-year career and a book of poetry called Verses. Throw that in there as well. Ani DiFranco joins me live in Studio Q. Hello.
Hello.
How'd I do?
You did beautifully. And what am I supposed to do now?
Well, how are you?
I'm good. Really good. It's nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
We have all kind of history, huh?
Yeah, I guess
back
so.
Back in the folk festival
back
days.
Back in the days, yeah. You know,
getting folky with it.
I'm thinking about you, and I'm thinking about 19 records, and I'm thinking about when artists decide, okay, I'm ready to put out the greatest hits record. I'm ready to put it all together or to try and put as much as I can together. And I wonder about that decision and what this moment, what led to that and what this moment means for you to be sitting here with a 2-CD set of,
yeah, right,
of the retrospective.
Yeah, well, oftentimes it means you're done, right? You know, you're like, you're grasping for straws. But I'm hoping that's not what it means for me. You know, I still have a pile of new songs and... it was just, it seemed like, you know, with, I don't know, 19 studio records or something stupid at this point, it was, you know, due time to put out a distillation, you know, for the uninitiated. Where do you even start, you know? So, and this year I had a baby, so I took some time off the road and it seemed like the perfect, I told myself, all right, I'm just going to sit here and get fatter and get some stuff done. You know, these projects, the poetry book being another one that was always on the back burner, never had time for it. And so the compilation, the poetry book, I finally sort of dialed them in while I was fattening up for last year's Thanksgiving.
You don't look like you've been fattening up.
Well, it's amazing what happens, the bounce back.
I want to ask you about the baby. I want to ask you about the poetry book. But first, you know, if I remember you correctly, You didn't always, or you haven't always loved listening back to your previous stuff. You know, you're always looking forward.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yes.
So what was it like emotionally, I suppose, like
really
revisiting all of these songs and listening back to your records to decide what's going to be on the greatest hits?
Traumatic. Awful.
Seriously?
Total shame spiral. Yeah, yeah, really. You know, it's just, but it was also, you know, I think I was finally ready just because I'm happy these days, you know. The kid's father, you know, is just making me nauseatingly happy. I have a kind of a new life that's really fortifying emotionally, and so it was a good moment emotionally to try and listen back to the old records.
Why was it traumatic?
You know, I feel like I still stand by a lot of those songs, but the recordings of them bug me, you know? I wish that there were better snapshots of my little kids out in the world, you know? So it's endlessly frustrating to me.
You've really, if not paved the way, you've been one of the people who's been fiercely independent from the beginning, Ani. Mm. But at times, there's a downside to that. And I wonder, the responsibility of running the ship, etc. But in this case, picking the songs, it's been funny reading a couple of reviews of the record, even from fans of yours, you know, journalists who seem to really like you, and sort of saying, well, the one thing an artist shouldn't do is pick her own songs, because she missed this song and this song.
Oh, really?
How do you react to the idea that somebody else would have a more objective view of what the Ani DiFranco canon should be than the artist herself who lives through
it? Well, that's the story of my career, isn't it? I mean, I could have had all kind of objective producers and mixers and players of instruments, but no, I had to go on my own self-exploratory journey and, you know, learning journey. So
you were a musical phenomenon. You were a feminist phenomenon in when you emerged in the 90s, a female icon at that time. Now, from the lens of 2007, looking back, were you comfortable with that?
I think I'm a lot more comfortable with it now than I was at the time, you know, but at the time I was being confronted with this manic, you know, adulation kind of energy all the time. And it was overwhelming, and it was, you know, no matter how much you give in your music, people want more, more, more. You know, they want a photo and a hug and a blood sample and a lock of your hair. And
part of that adulation that you talk about and the icon that you became led to a lot of expectations, especially from your cult fans, the people around you who adored you at the same time, expected you to be certain, act and say and do certain things, and including the songs that you wrote. Mm-hmm. And it's a really interesting decision on this retrospective double album, because you've decided to put Distracted on there, which is a little snippet of you talking live in 1997, mm-hmm. and actually emoting in front of the audience about what people are expecting of you, right. And why you're writing the songs you're writing. I want to play that for people right now. Let's just give us a little of that Distracted.
So, I don't know if you've heard this new little album that I put out, but there's been all this. This song is newer than it, but it's very much in that same kind of tortured, melodramatic kind of self-absorbed sort of a vein. And so now it's so funny, like just a couple of them that, you know, got their little panties on a little too tight. They're like all in a twitch, because they're, you know, they're like, oh, well, you know, now you wench just writing about like love and shit. You're not like, and what happened to your politics? And you're, you know, what are you just going to sell out and be like, you know, blah, blah, blah. And is this a conscious move away from overly political songwriting? Blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, no, man. It's like, it's just, I got kind of distracted.
That's Andre DeFranco on stage in 1997, and a little snapshot that's included in this two-disc retrospective canon that's come out in the last couple of months. And Ani's here with me in Studio Q. So is that you on stage being accommodating and trying to bring your fans along, or is that you pissed off?
Jeez, I think just responding to my environment. I used to read stuff about me and listen to what people were saying, and then I realized that I spent way too much time responding to it or caring about it, and it's distracting in and of itself, you know, because you simply can't please everybody. You know, for every person there's a different perception of what you should be and what you should be doing and wearing and talking about, and so there's just no way to live your life for other people successfully, so why try?
At the same time as celebrating you, your greatest fans also hold you to such scrutiny. I remember when you landed on the cover of Spin magazine.
Right.
Ani sold
Big
out.
Big crime. Yeah. Yes, because I let
how
somebody take my picture. Yeah.
And so how did you learn to shut that out?
Well, basically, you just have to be okay with yourself, right? You just have to know when you look in the mirror that you're living up to your own ideals and your own expectations of yourself. And, you know, I put on a dress and I sold out, you know, like, and it made me think, why is symbols of femininity equate passivity or you know, hey, what, can't I put on a dress and still be empowered? They are definitely attending to every detail, my listeners.
You said you're more comfortable now then, with the icon status, with all of that. Tell me about where you see yourself now.
Oh, geez. Well, very grateful, I would say, in a word. I just, I've really loved the ride. I loved the many years of obscurity. I love
When were the years of obscurity?
Oh, well,
I missed those. I didn't realize you'd been obscure.
Oh, geez.
Do you perceive?
Dude, I started, whatever, playing out in bars when I was 16.
Oh, I see. The first couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, I guess by the time we had met, and we were, what, both in our early 20s, things were already getting a little weird and crazy and good. But yeah, at this point, you know, my audience is big enough that I have help, you know. I mean, back when we were intersecting at folk festivals, I was alone.
Is that what we were doing? Intersecting?
Well, I was like, hey, I remember you from that other field.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, you know, I was alone, you know, with doing everything, you know. It was overwhelming. But now I have enough of an audience that I can have help. You know, I have a good crew, so I'm in a really good place. And I just feel, you know, more appreciative for the interactions that I have out there in the world. You know, they seem, they're very real, very genuine.
Including with a new baby. Congratulations officially on that. And obviously I have to ask you about the baby. I mean, lots seems to have changed for you recently. You had this baby. You've published this collection of lyrics and poems called Verses. They're very searching and self-aware. Your work has always been self-aware. I wonder if having a child, this is the inevitable question, right? You have a child. It changes that self-awareness or makes it more important.
Geez. No, I think it... Well, I mean, no, I don't know. Well, I was thinking that at this point with the kid around, I get to be less about myself, you know? I mean, think less about myself, quite literally, you know? I mean, I don't have the time or space to, you know, I mean, when can I even write do my work and process my life like I used to when she's napping, you know?
Does your awareness...
Yeah, sure.
So your awareness is less narcissistic, less personal?
Yeah, sure, right. And I think that's great, you know, and I appreciate having, you know, somebody say, stop doing what you do for a change and sit here and play with the grass, you know, with me. And, you know, so my life is somewhat more zen than it used to be and less, you know, I'm less of a workaholic and more of a mom. And it's a good change.
You've also chosen this time to out yourself in terms of your visual art skills. So there's paintings, there's drawings, there's that are also included in this book, which you've never really let go of in the same way. How do you feel about that? Exposing different sides of you as an artist now.
Well, you know, typically dubious. I don't have a lot of belief in myself as a visual artist, just because I haven't been out there doing it. I guess. I mean, I think we should all feel completely at home expressing ourselves in whatever way, and it's not a competition or something. It's just a big chorus, you know. So I guess my instinct is always to show it, to show myself, you know. Okay, well, here's my little doodles and my paintings, and while we're at it, you know.
But you didn't show those before.
No, that's a new... No. Well, I mean, yeah, I guess on record covers and stuff, I would sometimes get involved in the graphics, but yeah, the visual artist side of me was never really in public like it is in this book.
Is it important for you to always feel a bit anxious to test yourself?
Jeez, I don't think so. I wish that I was not, you know. I think that some of my best moments are when I just, whatever, when I'm really in touch with the whatever of, you know, don't be so concerned with how you appear or what does this person think of you or what, you know, just that's not what's important.
Would you consider yourself a brave person?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess so. I mean, I just look at the facts, just the facts, you know, of my life. And I guess I'm happy that I was instilled with a lot of independence and bravery early on.
I'm going to ask you to sing a song for us or play for us.
Geez.
But before I do that...
Will you be supportive?
I will. Just like your parents.
Even I
will
if I suck? Okay. That's great, Ani.
I don't think you're going to...
Really great.
Good job.
Good job.
Before I let you go walk over there and play a song for us, that is, I wonder about, you know, in terms of this being a turning point. Can we call it that? The
yes,
baby, the retrospective record.
Yeah.
So that if it's a turning point, the future, and how you want to, I know you're playing some gigs coming up with Dennis Kucinich, the presidential candidate. That seems like a very overt place to house your politics with a specific candidate. I wonder how you see yourself expressing yourself musically and politically in the near future. I'm not going to ask you what you're going to do 20 years from now, but
yeah. Well, Dennis is just a friend of mine and somebody I think has a lot of great ideas, you know. So he's coming out to a few shows on this tour to speak about energy policy and not allowing ourselves to be duped into thinking nuclear power is a solution to global climate change, etc.
What are you going to play for us?
Thought I'd play a song called 78% Water because it's on a little tenor guitar, one of my favorite axes.
All right. Is that little thing over there?
That little thing over
there. Let's get you over
all
there.
All right, then.
Ani DeFranco live in Studio Q, a song that appears on the new record, Canon, the new double record, Canon, 78% Water. She's picked up the little axe. She's sitting on the stool. She's fixing her hair. No, she's not fixing her hair. That's just a, it's an old lyric.
Okay. Joy had left your body, and you were locked in to your own thoughts. You used to love to sit by the water and watch it lapping on the rocks. And every time you'd put your feet in, you'd cry out and you'd pray. But it's all downhill from here, baby. So can't stay. First you'll roll your eyes to heaven, say you never had love so divine. But it will go from more than ever to not enough in no time. Yes, you will push in, you will push in, till you push me away. Hear you cry out for your water, and I know you'll curse it someday. I guess for me there's been a few who've walked up smiling and drawn a line between so far and from now on. Yes, a big glowing line in time. And I've been disappointed, I've been heartbroken. Yes, I too have loved from afar. But we are 78% water, even our pumping hearts.
Live in Studio Q, that's Ani DeFranco playing 78% Water, a song that appears on her 2006 record, Reprieve, and is also on a new record that she's just released, a double album entitled Canon. Thanks for coming in today.
Sure is good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Yeah. You long-haired girl?
It's short-haired, boy.
That's the long and the short of it. Ani DeFranco's latest CD is called Canon. She's also published her first book of poetry called Verses, and you can find them both by going to righteousbabe.com. Righteousbabe.com.
It's right.
This is Q, the podcast. Let us know what you think. Send us an email at q@cbc.ca.
Well, it is serious season for Hollywood, the time when studios release their prestige pictures, the films that they see as possible Oscar contenders. Now, this year's serious movies have a particular sense of urgency with subject matter touching on the ongoing war in Iraq. Last week saw the release of the Robert Redford-directed Lions for Lambs, and this week it's a film we mentioned yesterday on Q, Redacted, from filmmaker Brian De Palma. That makes 7 Hollywood films on Iraq released or about to be released. What does it all mean? War movies are a classic genre, so do these Iraq-themed films add anything new to the cinematic mix? And are they lending insight to a war that we're living through now? Here with a look at the latest era of war movies is Q's versatile man of visual entertainments, Jesse Wente. Hello.
Hi, Gian.
You must be excited about Spider-Man Online.
That stuff is made for geeks like me, John. I mean, the internet is at the service of geeks at all moments, and there's another great example.
So let me start at the beginning. What do you make of, and I know you were involved in the Toronto International Film Festival, where I first saw this spate of war films. You know, it seemed like every other film was about Iraq or Afghanistan or something to do with the American position on the war. What do you make of that, first of all, the spate of films?
You know, it's interesting. It's sort of a phenomenon, I think, that feeds a bit on itself. I mean, I think its response, part of it is just the era we live in. I mean, for so long, people have been making movies about wars, but they would always take years, sometimes decades after the war was over, for a film to ever come out. You know, All Quiet on the Western Front, that great World War One movie, that didn't come out until about 12 years after the war was over. And in general, until now, Gian, that had really sort of been the way it worked. I mean, there was always a few years before we saw the movies being made.
The Vietnam films came after a decade
or so. Certainly after the States was out of out of the war, by the time we saw Deer Hunter or Apocalypse Now in the late 70s. Yeah. Here, though, what we've seen is so much footage on the internet. The news has been there, but also non-traditional forms of media like YouTube, where you see these soldiers' diaries, that I think has just informed that so many fictional filmmakers, they have so much more access, even from afar, from half the world away, to this war than they have ever before. And I think because the war is so controversial, that's where you get a lot of these passions coming out. And so it's sort of a phenomenon that feeds upon itself because of the times.
So would you argue that these new war films are more reactive than to trying to actually affect the agenda in a way that previously films would be, in retrospect, you know, giving their opining about what happened?
Yeah, I mean, war movies traditionally have often sort of had the grander themes in mind, the sort of struggle of nature, the man at war, that sort of idea. And I think you're right. These are more reactive in a sort of Michael Moore style way, where they're coming out and trying to affect policy. And almost on all of them seem to have this idea in common that the regular media, the mainstream media, has somehow failed in the reporting of this war, and that it's now up to filmmakers, whether they're documentary or fiction filmmakers, to somehow fill that gap. And that's why we're seeing just so many of them trying to impart information that they don't think is coming across in any other way.
Yeah, something they actually say in their films.
The
media hasn't done their job. So, I mean, in some cases, it's quite didactic, not unlike what you might see in Lions for Lambs and Redactic. These are two films that deal with the media and the war, but in different ways. I've got my opinions about both of these films. We'll get to that maybe, because I just can't stay mum on it. But first of all, give us a sense of these two films and the difference in their approach.
Well, Lions for Lambs, which is directed by Redford and also stars him, is a very sort of traditional Hollywood-style movie. It tells three different stories all at once. Redford actually plays a university professor, political science professor, trying to convince a politically disillusioned student to somehow keep up with politics. You've got the story of these two soldiers essentially dying uselessly on a mountaintop in Afghanistan. And then you've got the very sort of overt and probably the strongest part of the film, which is Tom Cruise as this hawkish Republican senator who graces the presence of a fallen journalist played by Meryl Streep for a single interview to get his point across.
What is this?
This.
This meeting.
This is my honest effort to keep the press better informed and to change the subject from the past to the future, acknowledge mistakes, and talk openly about ways of fixing them, step by step.
How much time do we have together?
I have till 11.
The whole hour? Wow. You all must be panicked.
Oh, no. We're determined.
Now, later in the film, Gian, Streep even admits...
Why are you laughing?
Because it's a fairly comical sort of dialogue there. You know, she even admits that she's sort of gone as a reporter. She has this confrontation with her editor, all about trying to get the truth out, but of course he shoots her down. Very cynical about the media, but really doesn't offer much insight beyond sort of that sort of blame throwing. Mm. On the other side, you have Redacted, which I think is far more interesting.
One second on the Lions for Lambs.
Yeah.
Because, first of all, it's not my major problem with the film, but the casting of Tom Cruise is really odd.
He clearly relishes the role.
He relishes the role, but I saw it in a public screening. The audience laughed at one point because there's pictures of him with George W. Bush. And that it's conceivable that those are actual pictures of Tom Cruise with George W. He's playing a character, but it doesn't.
I assumed they were.
Why would you cast someone we can't get away? You know, in terms of our mind, I never once really saw him as a senator. I think he's a pretty good actor, Tom Cruise. I'm not taking that away from him. I thought it was weird casting.
It was interesting to pass someone to cast someone whose ideology we're all very familiar with in a role playing someone who's espousing an ideology we're perhaps all very familiar with. I think there was perhaps some cleverness, but I actually think that's maybe giving too much credit to Redford on the casting there. I think they were trying to open the movie big. Tom Cruise hadn't had a below box office. His movies have been number one on opening weekend for 15 years. This is the first one that wasn't, which perhaps speaks to the sort of desire for this sort of thing.
Right.
Redacted, I think, is a little bit more interesting ultimately as a film and more successful as a film because it's so innovative in its approach. It actually uses a lot of the media we're familiar with out of this war, whether it's diaries by soldiers, whether it's internet stuff on YouTube, films made by Iraqis, and it's all surrounded by this sort of fake documentary made by this French television crew, and it adds the film, I think, a certain measure of authenticity to it.
Thank you. Y'all want to hear telling you how it is?
You, yeah.
What do y'all think is going to be the first casualty of this entire conflict, huh?
You.
It's not going to be Rush or Flake or Don't Ask, Don't Tell over here. You know what it's going to be? It's going to be the truth.
Now, again, a fairly obvious sort of a bit of dialogue, a criticism I think could be leveled at this film as well. But what's interesting about this movie is it's actually about a true event. The event that happens in this rape and murder of this 15-year-old Iraqi girl and her family did actually occur. And I think what's interesting about Redacted is it's a film that almost criticizes itself by using all these different media. It's really sort of commenting on movies exactly like it while also criticizing actually what's going on in the war and trying to present stuff that maybe we don't necessarily see in the mainstream media. So ultimately, you know, the much better movie.
Obviously, Brian De Palma was on the show yesterday, it was difficult to not ask him why did you make such an ineffective film? Because that's my perspective. I thought that it was a great idea to include all this multimedia, but I also felt like, to a certain extent, that hampered the film in that the story becomes secondary to the tricks, to the, you know, all the, and I also felt like it's a lot of what we were seeing in Brian De Palma's effort to give this a contemporary kind of look is what we see on television.
Yes.
And therefore, I wonder if that, and that leads to my question about why this stuff isn't, I mean, we'll see what happens with Redacted, but doesn't seem to be selling with audiences. Is it that audiences are sick of already seeing about the war, whether it's the right perspective or not, what they getting from the media, that they don't want to go to a theater and have to watch it again?
I think there is something to that, but I wonder, to your previous point about Redacted, I wonder if the fact that the story is a little bit lost isn't perhaps part of the point, ultimately, with that movie, that we, in all of this engagement and all these videos from everywhere, we actually lose a little bit of sight of the bigger picture.
Good point.
I think there's true. I mean, none of the war movies, and there's been seven or about to be seven by the end of the year, have made money. I mean, even the action one with Jamie Foxx called The Kingdom hasn't quite made back its budget yet.
And even a really good film like A Mighty Heart, the one about
Angelina Jolie
and Marianne Pearl, nothing.
No, and made by a completely competent filmmaker, Michael Winterbottom, and I mean, one of the most engaged filmmakers around. And I mean, I think part of that is there's this feeling of oversaturation because we get so much footage and YouTube and all of that, that there's a sense that maybe, despite the filmmakers sensing that there's a need to fill in these gaps, that maybe the audience doesn't have that need. But I also wonder, Jean, if these movies actually won't be bigger on DVD, much like we saw with the 9/11 movies like United 93, which bombed at the box office but actually did big DVD sales. Mm-hmm. You wonder if people aren't more willing to confront these films at home alone rather than on a Friday night at the theater, and maybe that's the sort of disconnect that's occurring.
Do you think that the very point that we started by talking about, that these films are being made during the war instead of having some critical perspective of something having happened in the past, affects the efficacy of them? I wonder with the Robert Redford film, part of what I was disappointed about, he's almost trumpeting throughout the film. I mean, he's in it.
Yeah.
This is a liberal film. And yet, to me, it seems like there's such an effort to affect American policy that all they're talking about in the film is, are too many Americans dying? What should the American policy be? They're actually the larger macro morality questions aren't discussed. They're not, you know, they say, you know, the only Afghanis or Iraqis or Arabs shown in the film are actually wailing crazy barbarians, killing people. There's nowhere in this film are they actually asking, should we be engaging in this war for moral reasons? It's all about American policy. There seems to be a lack of perspective in that sense in a film that is actually trumpeting itself as giving perspective.
It's the major problem with the movie. It's completely insular. It doesn't actually look out at all. And I think you're exactly right. I mean, wouldn't it have been easier to make a humanist movie by going to Afghanistan and shooting something there? I mean, I think you would get your liberal point across for Redford's sake. And ultimately with that film, nobody wants to sit in the theater and be lectured for 2 hours. I mean, it's excruciating. And I think that's ultimately what you get with that film. Redacted, I think you can engage with a little bit more, and at least it gets you talking. Whereas I think Lions for Lambs is nothing but talking points on Fox News that we can all see every night.
What does seem to be working in terms of really moving portrayals is the documentaries. And on this note, because we had Phil Donahue on the show, and a lot of people have reacted to that, a lot of people have asked, it's an outstanding documentary, Body of War, where and when they can see that. Is that going to be released, and are the documentaries going to find their way into the theaters as well?
Yeah, you would think so. I mean, I would think particularly that film would be. And in this era, actually, we've seen so many Iraqi war documentaries make it to the theater, and they've actually been far more effective in making the same points that these fictional movies have been, because they really are showing you what's going on at the ground, whether it's Gunner Palace or any of the other films out there. I think you will see that Donahue Body of War come out. I think these movies will come out.
Has it got distribution? Do you know?
I don't know on that one if it does, but you know, I would suspect certainly it would get a broadcast at some point on some channel somewhere. Those sorts of movies don't stay hidden for long.
Thanks, Jesse.
My pleasure.
Good to have a chance to talk to you. That's Jesse Wente. Lions for Lambs, the Robert Redford film, is in theaters now if you still want to see it after two guys have... And Redacted, the Brian De Palma film, opens on Friday. You've been listening to Q, the podcast. Hey, you can hear Q, the program, every weekday afternoon and evening on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Satellite 137. I'm Gian Gomeshi. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.